From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. The chairman of the Federal Reserve, Jerome Powell, warned today of a long recession and said the health of the economy will depend on more help from Congress.
The government has already pumped in trillions of dollars, but the numbers of coronavirus cases and deaths continue to rise. And even as the curve flattens in some states, it's spiking in others. Joining us now is Amish Adalja of the Johns Hopkins University Center for Health Security. Dr. Adalja, first, where are things getting better in this country and where are they getting worse?
So you're seeing a varied picture across the country, and each state is kind of in different parts of its epidemic. And one of the things that I caution people against doing is just looking at the sheer number of cases. It's, I think, a better measure to look at what's the percent positive of tests. So, for example, I'm in Pennsylvania right now, and our cases are going down. But there are states, for example, in the South that are going up. You're seeing places that have been hit with meatpacking plants or meat manufacturing plant outbreaks have cases go up. Places where jails have outbreaks are going up. So it's really a spotted type of thing, and I think it's better not to focus on just the number of cases, but to look at the total picture.
Well, but you mentioned meatpacking plants and you mentioned jails. What about places that have eased restrictions on social distancing or places that didn't have very tight restrictions to begin with? Are we seeing any effect of that? Or are you able to say places that have eased restrictions with social distancing are now starting to see more cases than places that have been locked down more?
It's a simple biological fact, is when you have people interacting with each other, you're going to see more cases. And that's not the best way to judge whether or not relaxation decisions were warranted or not. The real overriding principle to me is the new number of cases that you're going to get when you relax these restrictions, do they end up spilling into the hospital and putting your hospitals back into crisis? Because the virus isn't going anywhere, and it's not going to go anywhere until we have a vaccine, which may be 2 years and before the whole world or the whole country can be vaccinated. So the question will be, when you peel back these restrictions, you're going to get more cases. Some of those are going to end up in the hospital. Some of those are going to be fatal cases. But do you put your hospitals in crisis? And that's how you have to do this in a measured manner. And if you look, for example, at Georgia, which is one of the first states, they actually have the lowest numbers of hospitalization that they've had since this outbreak began, which is remarkable. But that's why these things have to kind of be done on a state-by-state level. And if you see your hospitals getting into crisis, then you have to start thinking about what restrictions should need to be in place to keep hospitals at that point where they can handle their normal operations as well as the case count from the coronavirus.
But when you say that Georgia is looking okay at the moment, and Georgia, we remember, it was almost a couple of weeks ago that Georgia said, okay, bowling alleys are allowed to open up, hair salons are allowed to open up, and then restaurants shortly thereafter are allowed to open up with social distancing. Why should a state in the Northeast not just do the exact same thing that Georgia has done, given that they've been able to, so far, with more than a week since they did this, keep things under control there?
Because not every place is the same. You have to look at other factors. That virus is going to be able to spread in a better manner if you're in a more population-dense area. That's one thing. The other thing is you have to look at what your hospital capacity is. I'm sitting in Pittsburgh right now speaking to you, and here we have a lot of excess hospital capacity all the time. And that put us in a very different position where we didn't get a major surge, whereas a place like New York City has trouble even during a severe flu season managing their capacity because they've had hospital closures and they have such population density and overcrowded emergency departments all the time. So you can't just say, because Georgia did well, another state can do well, because it could go wrong. And that's why it has to really be driven by the local dynamics. And you can have this basically right-sized to the area and the region that you're talking about.
The Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation at the University of Washington recently revised its model, almost doubling the number of deaths expected by August. My question to you is, are we any better off? Do we have any more of a handle on this virus than we did in March when the lockdowns began?
There are aspects of this virus that we do have a better handle on. We understand more about it. We understand more how to treat it. We have at least one antiviral that has some benefit, remdesivir, that can get people out of the hospital quicker. We're hearing less about personal protective equipment supply problems, and we're hearing less about hospital capacity now. But it's a simple fact that this virus is with us, that it is going to infect people until there is a vaccine, and people are going to die from it, that we're going to have to come to a societal decision about how we move forward with this virus in our midst, that this now becomes part of the risks that we take every time we step out of the door. And there are going to be vulnerable populations that are going to be highly susceptible to severe cases, and they're going to really have to be protected and fortified as best as we can. Some of this is going to come down to individual risk tolerance eventually as the governors start to open states back up. And it's going to be different for every person. But we have to be prepared to deal with the fact that we're going to have deaths from this virus. And they're going to increase the more you socially interact.
But would it be a reasonable decision for a governor to make right now to say, okay, we're going to open back up with social distancing, but we're going to open up, and if you are over a certain age or if you have a pre-existing condition that puts you at greater risk of getting very sick or dying from this virus, then you should continue to stay at home. But other people can go out and get the economy going again.
I do think increasingly you're going to see stay-at-home orders have that kind of nuance, saying if you're in a vulnerable population, the stay-at-home order persists for you. Because this virus is going to be with us. There is not a vaccine available for you. So the risk of you contracting this and ending up in the hospital is still going to be substantial. One third of all deaths in this country have been in nursing home patients. So that's going to be really crucial to be able to cocoon that population as best as you can. Basically keep nursing homes on lockdowns. And it's going to be hard because you can't completely sequester that group of the population. So it will be something that is going to be very challenging to do. But I increasingly think that's the path that we're going to have to take as we move forward. And these governors are removing some of the social restrictions, and we're starting to get the economy and people's lives back in order.
That is Dr. Amish Adalja, who's a senior scholar at the Johns Hopkins University Center for Health Security. Dr. Adalja, thank you so much again.
Thank you.
Well, the House Democrats' proposal of a $3 trillion coronavirus aid package includes nearly $900 billion for state and local governments. And this comes as cities and towns scramble to develop budgets for their next fiscal year. As Jay Price of WUNC in North Carolina reports, those local governments are trying to do this while also figuring out exactly how much this outbreak will cost them.
The pandemic is expected to cut into nearly every source of local government revenue, from utility payments to taxes on retail sales, hotel rooms, and restaurant meals. Tony McDowell is Asheville's Assistant Director of Finance and has worked on budgets there for two decades.
The decline in some of our revenues in the short term, at least, are going to be beyond, I think, what any of us have ever seen before, A, and then B, we just don't know how long this is going to go on and how quickly the economy is going to recover after this.
McDowell says he's never experienced this kind of uncertainty while trying to put together a budget. At the North Carolina League of Municipalities, Executive Director Paul Meyer said the picture is murky and has changed quickly.
We are anticipating 25% decline in sales tax receipts for cities and towns. Now that number we're thinking is probably closer to 30-35%, and sales tax makes up about a third of the average city budget.
One clue will be how much sales tax receipts are down in the first quarter, which nationally showed the sharpest decline in economic activity since the Great Depression. But it takes about 3 months for sales tax money to work down from the state to local governments. Myers said whatever the final numbers, the hit will be sharp.
And then in 2020, 2021, we'll see unpaid property taxes start to kick in.
Property taxes are the main source of revenue for local governments. Meyer said that without federal aid to replace lost revenue, the effects of the pandemic will likely exceed those in the last major economic downturn a decade ago. Revenue problems could drag on for years, and local governments could shed employees and spend less on job-creating construction.
That's where local governments end up extending the recession. Again, that was a pattern that we saw in 2008-2010, same thing.
Others are looking to the Great Depression for lessons about what to expect. In the 1930s, 62 counties and 152 North Carolina towns and cities couldn't pay their debts. Many went bankrupt. Ironically, because North Carolina's local governments fared so badly then, most are better positioned to face this crisis than their peers in almost any other state. In response to the Depression, the state took control of the prisons, schools, and road building, and it formed a commission to oversee local government's finances.
They literally review in detail the external financial statements and other reports that every government in the state has to provide.
That allows them to catch potential problems, says Greg Allison of the University of North Carolina's School of Government.
Governments that are either in financial distress and there's a variety of reasons why that was happening even before the pandemic, or those that are kind of on the edge of it, that one misstep or one problem could really get them in trouble.
Even before the pandemic, the commission had put dozens, mainly small towns, on a watch list. State Treasurer Dale Falwell heads the commission.
Now we're faced, obviously, with a pandemic where the expenses of a lot of these municipalities are staying the same, possibly even going up, but the revenues are going to collapse.
Among other things, the commission requires local governments to build savings to cushion against unexpected problems. But Paul Meyer said even fund balances regarded as healthy only represent 2 or 3 months of operations and could quickly be used up in such a major downturn unless the local governments get help.
Once they eat into that, there'll only be two options, and that'll be cutting services, which will equal personnel, or raising taxes on what's left.
And what's left will be people and businesses with less income to afford those taxes. For Here and Now, I'm Jay Price.
If it feels like through all of this, you're paying more for your groceries, you're right. The U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics reports that in April, we saw the sharpest increase in nearly 50 years. For more, we're joined by Kirk Maltese. He reports on food prices for the Wall Street Journal. Hey, Kirk.
Hi, Tanya.
So there are so many staples that we're now paying more for if you're able to actually get your hands on them. So we're seeing that a dozen eggs now cost more than $3, and there have been price gouging lawsuits filed in California and Texas over this. Why are eggs so expensive right now?
Well, the problem with eggs and really anything in the supply chain, it's not the availability of the raw material, eggs, meat, grains, whatever have you. All of that is abundantly available in the United States. It's just that the process of being able to get it from the farm to processing to, you know, your store shelves, that's the issue that's come up, and that's because of COVID-19 making workers sick. Before this, egg prices were, you know, at record lows. Because it's not able to get to the grocery store, you know, they've had to get rid of eggs on the supply end. It's just the transporting it from point A to point B is the problem.
Yeah. What about flour? There was a nearly 3% increase in prices for cereal and bakery products last month, and we're reading that it was the steepest single month increase on record. I thought I couldn't find it because people were baking more, but you've noticed that flour is just hard to find.
Yeah, it's something that globally, especially when COVID-19 first hit, there was a run on grocery stores for flour, wheat flour particularly, and that drove the prices of wheat higher for some time. You know, it's something where even now there's difficulty finding that specialty flour because the supply chains for grocery stores haven't adjusted to carrying enough inventory to, you know, cover for the increased consumer demand. And it's something where, you know, for example, my mom is she retired last year and she's gotten into, you know, making croissants. That's her big thing now. And yeah. There's a specialty flour that they use for croissants. I believe it's called pastry flour. And I mean, she can't find that, you know, in her grocery stores. It used to be something that, you know, was easily available.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about meat, specifically pork. You've talked about how livestock producers who say the supply chain is so off, they're now being forced to kill hogs. Now, explain this to us. I mean, and how does this affect prices?
Well, back in the beginning of the year, there was a record level of both hogs and cattle produced in the United States. So when COVID hit, food service, you know, your restaurants, your catering service, what have you, they were forced to shut down. You just have this issue where you then have this backlog of hogs that are on farms. They're on feed. It's tough to stop them from growing. I mean, the average hog that's on feed being prepared for slaughter grows at a rate of 2 pounds per day. And there's a certain weight level that these plants, whichever plants are open at this point, can actually take a hog. The normal hog that's slaughtered is roughly around 250 pounds, much more than that. And, you know, these facilities can't take them. They can't handle a hog that's over 330 pounds or so. So what mm-hmm. happens? I mean, these farmers, they're just forced into a situation where they can't sell their product. You know, these hogs are getting bigger, and what do? They've made the, you know, unfortunate choice that they have to, in some cases, euthanize them.
Oh, okay. So we're also reading that there is a global record rice production issue happening. So what does that actually mean? Does it mean that it's more plentiful or cheaper? Or are there concerns about the supply chain there too?
It is definitely a supply chain concern. The USDA said yesterday that global consumption of rice is expected to hit a record large. That's right around 500 million metric tons. But that said, I mean, the U.S. Production of rice is actually up 17% for this marketing year. So a lot of countries were adjusting to this increased demand for rice by producing more rice. So having is just the same thing that's happened in the other types of food products, where it's just an ability of the product to get to the store shelves.
Yeah. Kirk, you know, this is all happening as people are feeling the real effects of this pandemic on their pocketbook. Is there any sense that these supply chain problems will correct themselves in the next few weeks or months as we continue through this pandemic?
It's definitely a question of months. For example, agricultural lender CoBank said recently that they expect retail pork and beef prices to be up 20% in July versus last year. So it's something where, you know, at this point, we're looking at ground beef prices double of what they are this point last year. Even with some of these meat packers coming online, even with some things that were closed, slowly reopening, they have weeks now of shipments that they didn't make, the trips that they didn't take, stocking shelves that they didn't do that they have to make up for. And so it's something where we can try and work through the kinks, but we're still going to be feeling this. From looking at earnings calls and what have you, most of these companies are forecasting that we're going to be feeling this. They'll be feeling it on their bottom line well into the third and fourth quarter of 2020. And they expect some effects to be felt in 2021 as well.
Which affects all of us, of course.
Yes.
That's definitely. Kirk Maltese. He's a commodities reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Kirk, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Well, as more people take advantage of food delivery, the ride-hailing service Uber is reportedly in talks to acquire Grubhub. That's the second largest food delivery service. If that deal goes through, it would give the combined company a 55% market share. For more, let's bring in Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure on member station VPM. Welcome.
How are you?
I'm well, thank you. So, Robin, we've been reading that Uber approached Grubhub back in February. Folks are thinking about the timing of this. Did they see the writing on the wall with the impact of the coronavirus? Or was this a business move that was already in the making?
I just think a lot of this momentum was already set. Uber has been pruning its Uber Eats portfolio, selling in and out of countries for many months now. There are too many players in this space. On a local level, restaurants, which are really, really struggling right now, and especially dependent on carryout and delivery, they've been banding together to offer cheaper delivery outside the popular platforms, which take huge cuts even before drivers are tipped. So Uber and Grubhub and DoorDash and all of them have certainly been aware of that. I mean, it's been all the rage on Twitter if you look at the grievances the past few weeks.
Yeah. I want to talk to you a little bit more about that impact on drivers and consumers, but I want to talk more about what this acquisition actually means. So we're reading that it would be an all-stock takeover. Just briefly tell us what that means.
Yeah, you're using what's a more volatile currency to make a buyout in lieu of cash. Typically, you don't see companies eager to spend their stock. This deal could end up being very expensive if Uber stock ends up skyrocketing, but cash right now is king and everyone wants more of it to ride out what's going on.
Okay, so you mentioned it, but we've been seeing anecdotally that many Lyft and Uber drivers have already switched to food delivery as a means to make money. But I'm also wondering how this consolidation will possibly impact consumers.
Yeah, as you mentioned, Uber itself is already on so many smartphones, and that's a powerful foot in the door. Uber Eats now sports 20% of the market, and Grubhub has 28% as of March. So they both want to better compete with DoorDash, which controls 42% of the market. You would hope over time that this doesn't result in more gouging or hikes or pricing pressure at restaurants when they least need that, but that remains to be seen.
Yeah, the impact on restaurants. I mean, we've reported before how they often get squeezed by these food delivery fees. You see this pressure increasing.
Yeah, what I hear from the restaurant owners on my show is how brutally difficult it is to justify, say, 25 to 30% of a delivery ticket to a third-party app when your workers are furloughed, the sales are down enormously, and the rent is due. Do you just keep using these services to run in place while your dining room is idled? It's one thing if you're churning out high-volume, cheap-to-make product like pizza, but it's a whole other thing with a multi-course, labor-intensive lunch or dinner.
Yeah, I mean, let's talk about this a little bit more, because I know it's hard to say, but could the food delivery industry be actually heading in the direction over the next few years where delivery is the only option? You talked about how much easier it is for pizza parlors, for instance, but I actually talked to an owner in Florida who said that they may just close their dining services altogether and offer delivery only, which means we may become even more reliant on these services.
Yeah, it feels like we've just truly crossed the threshold. Even before this, more young urban people got into the habit of thinking you could just treat any meal anywhere like an Uber or Lyft passenger. So restaurants, they're now grappling with if and how they can afford to control this entirety of the experience on their own, particularly when drivers are demanding better pay, you know, PPE, safeguards, even health insurance. And I do think you're going to see more consolidation if this does indeed happen. Look at DoorDash and Postmates. Watch Amazon Prime, which has food delivery, Instacart, and I'd especially watch the publicly traded restaurant chains, Chipotle, McDonald's, Starbucks, you know, even the parent of Olive Garden. How are they going to collaborate to counter this Uber Grubhub colossus if the deal in fact happens?
That's Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure on member station VPM. Robin, as always, thanks.
My pleasure.
Authorities in South Korea said today they do not plan to revive strict social distancing rules, despite a recent spike of more than 100 coronavirus cases linked to nightclubs in Seoul. Let's bring in NPR's Anthony Kuhn. And Anthony, what more do we know about this new spike in cases?
Well, this latest cluster, which is the biggest seen in Seoul, is being traced to a 29-year-old man who went to visit five nightclubs and bars in Seoul's Itaewon district on the night of May 1st. And now this cluster has spread to about half a dozen other cities and provinces. And what's really concerning to authorities is they don't know where it began. They think that this 29-year-old man may not be the first case. He may just be the first case they know about. And in fact, COVID-19 has been spreading undetected within local communities.
You know, we've been hearing from health officials that relaxing social distancing restrictions too soon could mean a second wave of infections. And South Korea was known for its ability to quell this disease very early on. Why aren't authorities imposing restrictions in response to this spike?
Basically because they knew this was going to happen and they were prepared for it. Now, it was very distressing for residents, for people who live here, because locally transmitted cases were down to zero for several days in a row before this new cluster hit. But they knew this was going to happen, and so they built it into their new, easier social distancing policies. And President Moon Jae-in said, as long as people keep up their guard, we can return to normal life and, you know, not stress out our public health system.
Okay, so this recent spike in cases kind of falls under the number that they were looking at in the expectation of the number of new cases each day.
That's right. At the same time, they are being very cautious because they're not sure how fast and how widely it's being spread. So what they're trying to do is get out way ahead of it. In those five clubs, there were about 1,500 people on the night that that patient visited. But what they're doing is sending out text messages to anybody who visited the entire neighborhood within a couple of weeks of that night and telling them to get tested. So they've already tested more than 20,000 people in connection with this case, and they're relying on these contact tracing systems using cell phone data, credit card histories, surveillance camera footage to identify people not just who are in the clubs, but who are in the neighborhood, and telling them to get tested.
But there's something else. Anthony, what role is the stigmatization of the LGBTQ community in South Korea, and how is this playing out? Because the clubs that you're talking about in question were considered gay nightclubs and bars.
That's right. And as a result, some people who had not gone public with their orientation did not want to get tested. And so the government has told the public, don't discriminate against these people. The virus certainly doesn't. Anyone can get it. And if you do discriminate, it means that these people won't be, will be unwilling to get tested. And luckily, South Korea has a very robust civil society, and civic groups have come forth and said they will try to help these LGBTQ groups. And they're slowly beginning to track down everyone who was near the clubs or in the neighborhood.
Hmm. That's NPR's Anthony Kuhn in Seoul. Thank you so much, Anthony.
You're welcome, Tanya.
It is still an election year, despite the pandemic. Election Day is less than 6 months away. The presumptive Democratic nominee Joe Biden is still trying to shore up support across his party. Biden and former rival Bernie Sanders announced a joint unity task force to do just that. And President Trump heads to the swing state of Pennsylvania tomorrow to visit a medical supply company. We're joined now by NPR political correspondent Asma Khalid. And let's start with this unity task force. Biden made the announcement with Bernie Sanders. Clearly, this is part of Biden's attempt to shore up Democratic support. There are still Democrats who say he shouldn't be the one leading the ticket. How has this effort been going for him?
Well, the unity task force you mentioned is certainly a step toward building that, you know, unity and good feelings within the party. And I would say in part because one of the most high profile names participating in this effort will be Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. You know, she's a leading progressive voice in the Democratic Party. She'll be co-chairing the climate change task force along with former Secretary of State John Kerry. But look, I would say, you know, the acrimony that I think many of us recall from 2016 between Sanders' world and Hillary Clinton's world is just not what we're seeing as much this year. And I'm not saying that there are not hurt feelings. There certainly are amongst some folks. But I think that both Sanders and Biden have individually made a lot of overtures to unite the party. And this task force, in fact, goes back to a pledge that the two men made when Sanders officially endorsed Biden last month. You know, it was not just an endorsement. It was a sense, they said, to come together and form these working groups on six policy issues like immigration and health care, and then they would take those recommendations to both the DNC and to Joe Biden. You know, I think the main question for me, Jeremy, though, is that even if we are seeing like leadership within the progressive organization, which we've seen, you know, progressive organizations come out and support Joe Biden. The question that remains is because we're in such a non-traditional campaign year, you know, how much that really affects grassroots energy on the ground. And I don't know the answer to that because we really just aren't hearing and getting a chance to talk to a lot of voters right now.
Can't get out on the ground. One thing that could help Biden get some Democrats excited is going to be his choice for vice president. Where is he with that decision, and is it likely he'll make it soon?
Well, in terms of where he's at, he's announced a vice presidential search committee. He's named who's going to be on that. And they are now in the job process right now of vetting candidates. That process has just begun. You know, there are more than a dozen names that have been considered, all women, because we should point out that, as Joe Biden has himself said, he is committed to picking a woman as his running mate. In terms of a timeline, he has said that he intends to have the vetting wrapped up by the summer. And it's often tradition to announce the VP pick officially just right before the convention. And now that the Democratic convention has been postponed until August, it gives him even more time. You know, what I will say is that Joe Biden, perhaps more than a traditional presidential candidate, cares a lot about the relationship between the president and the vice president. And, you know, I think we hear a lot of pundits talk about, you know, who might give him a geographic edge or who might give him a demographic edge. But one thing that we hear consistently from Biden is he wants someone who he is simpatico with, someone whom he trusts. And I think that matters a lot to him because he's been in the job before.
Well, and also because whoever Biden picks is going to be the vice president for the oldest elected president that we've ever had in a first term. So that'll be important as well.
Exactly.
And meanwhile,
so he has definitely said he's going to pick someone younger than him. I will say that. That he has made very clear when he said what he was looking for.
Meanwhile, the coronavirus has given President Trump a platform to get out his campaign message. Here he is talking in the Rose Garden Monday about his coronavirus response.
To battle a virus, my administration marshaled every resource at our nation's disposal. Public, private, military, economic, scientific, and industrial, all at your disposal.
Now, as we said, the president is heading to a medical factory in Pennsylvania tomorrow. This is the second trip after his trip out to Arizona last week. How are these trips playing into his campaign?
Well, I would say, you know, where the one thing we should definitely point out is that he is visiting states that he needs to win in November. I mean, these are states that are very close. Arizona is a state Republicans won in 2016. It's looking to be very tight. Pennsylvania is a state that Donald Trump won. And so what I will say is that these trips allow him to travel in person. He has not been able to hold campaign rallies, but he's been able to visit states, which means that he commands the local news in those places. And one thing I consistently hear from analysts when I talk to them is that one of the biggest challenges that both Biden and Trump face right now is that they just have not been able to get a lot of local news coverage because they're not able to hold rallies in town. And Trump has that advantage. You know, you can argue whether or not these trips are, you know, presidential in nature or whether they are campaign. But I think the benefit to Trump is still the same. He's able to get attention in key swing states that he needs to win in November.
When you mentioned local news, that is one of the most trusted forms of news in this country. So it is very important for these candidates to be able to get on local news. Joe Biden, for his part, Asma, says he's trying to set an example by staying at home. He's got that studio in his basement in Delaware. Here he is in an interview with ABC's Good Morning America yesterday.
Everybody says, you know, Biden's hiding. Well, let me tell you something. We're doing very well. We're following the guidelines of the medical profession. We're following the guidelines of the experts, of the Dr. Fauci's of the world. We're doing very well. And that matter of fact, we're winning if you look at all the polling data.
Now, when he talks about winning in the polls, there is a poll out today that has Biden ahead just barely in Georgia, which hasn't been competitive in a presidential race in a long time. It's still early, of course. But what are polling trends telling us now?
You know, I think what Biden is saying, which I think is valid here, is that despite the fact he has not been holding rallies, you know, he's not been able to just go out and campaign in a traditional format, his support seems to have been fairly steady. And at the same time, we see that President Trump, who is governing the country right now in a moment of crisis, has not seen that normal uptick that you might expect. You know, we think back to George W. Bush right after 9/11. Traditionally, in a moment of crisis, there is this desire to unite around the president. We're just not seeing that in the case of President Trump. You know, my caution here with polls, as you mentioned, is that it's so early. You know, and you think back to 2016, and there were so many polls that showed Hillary Clinton with an advantage early on. So I'm just really hesitant to kind of overinterpret the polls at this moment, specifically when really we know that this competition is likely to come down to a couple of key battleground states.
Biden has had to respond to allegations that he sexually assaulted a Senate staffer in the 1990s. Now, you've been reporting on this for a while. Is it going anywhere? Is there any new information forthcoming? Or is this going to be a he said, she said that will dog Biden until Election Day?
You know, in terms of how long this story will dog Biden, I don't know the answer to that. And I think in part it just depends on, A, whether or not Democrats feel that he has sufficiently answered the questions, and B, whether or not Donald Trump and the Trump campaign continue to bring this up as an issue. What I will say is that Tara Reid herself gave an interview recently to Megyn Kelly. This was her first on-camera interview after Joe Biden had publicly addressed the allegations. Not a lot of new information came out in that interview, so the degree to which the story will continue, I haven't really heard a lot of new information since then. I think the main question is, you know, Joe Biden has done a couple of interviews now since, I believe it was on Good Morning America, he was also asked a question about this, and on Morning Joe, you know, the degree to which it continues to be asked of him. He has now answered the question and said that this is not true, that he did not, you know, sexually assault this woman, Tara Reid, who has accused him of doing this in the 1990s. But I honestly just don't know the degree to which we will continue to hear this, in part because Donald Trump himself faces a whole slew of sexual assault allegations. So I don't know the degree to which Trump or his campaign thinks it is, you know, politically prudent to try to bring these allegations up again and again against Joe Biden.
Let me finally ask you, you mentioned the convention coming up in the summer. Now, it was pushed back, but do we really think there are going to be political conventions in the month of August? Or what's it going to be like?
Well, Lara Trump, who's an advisor to her father-in-law's campaign, told reporters on a press call yesterday that the Republicans are planning to meet in Charlotte this August as scheduled. So that is what we are hearing from the Republican side. On the other hand, the Democrats are developing contingency plans for a possible remote convention. What we have heard on the Democratic side is that they want to give convention organizers the ability to try to figure out if there are ways for people to participate, whether that means virtually or participate in some way where they don't have to physically be there to cast a ballot. So I guess this is all to say we just don't know what it will look like at this point. I think if you talk to sort of outside analysts, the consistent thing I'm hearing is a lot of skepticism over will the country be ready to have thousands of people together in one room in a traditional format like we normally do at a convention when, a lot of states still haven't even lifted fully their stay-at-home orders.
Yeah, and especially when we're hearing already about universities saying we're not going to have people in the fall in classes, the idea of a huge convention. We'll see. We'll see. Stay tuned. Asma Khalid, NPR political correspondent, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Small banks have already handed out most of the credit to small businesses trying to get a lifeline through the federal government's Paycheck Protection Program. That's according to the business publication Barron's. Today, we hear from employees of one bank near Boston to understand how their jobs have changed as they rush to get emergency loans to businesses in need. Adrian Ma from member station WBUR reports.
Since the Paycheck Protection Program started in early April, Lindsay St. Pierre has been living and breathing PPP loans.
It's been a roller coaster, to be totally honest, because it really had a bit of a shaky start.
St. Pierre is a business banking officer at Brookline Bank, a small lender based in Massachusetts. And she's often the first person business owners in her area go to when they need cash. She answers their questions, helps them fill out paperwork.
It sounds simple, but when you have, a couple hundred at a time coming in at the same day, it's not. I think I looked at one point in 30 days, I sent like 1,800 emails. It was crazy. It's just so much back and forth. I'm like, I think I'm getting arthritis in my fingers just from typing all day long.
Have you ever had to work this much before?
Not like this. It's strange because it's mentally draining, especially when we're really racing against the clock to make sure these people get their funding. If I drop the ball on one, that's a whole business that could, potentially go under.
St. Pierre says it is a lot to carry, especially since on the day I spoke with her, she was also carrying something else. She was pregnant.
I'm due in 10 days, so.
Oof.
Yeah.
Even so, she says she has been working about 14 hours a day, and so have a lot of her colleagues.
It's gotten crazy. It's gotten really crazy.
Yes. Kevin Noyes is a vice president for Brookline Bank, which has processed more than 1,100 loans so far. Unlike a lot of his employees, Noyes is still going into the office. And despite the craziness, he still gives off a vibe that might be best described as relentlessly cheerful. Like, he often ends his sentences with an affirming, yep, yep.
I got up at 5:30. Yeah, and I was here by between 6:30 and 7. Yep, yep.
Now, every PPP loan request has to go to the U.S. Small Business Administration for approval. But the online system banks file those requests to has often been jammed. So the bank found a way to avoid the rush by filing applications in the middle of the night.
Start them around 11 o'clock. We had a team of people that were really happy to do it. And they would start at 11 and finish around 4. And we got ours through without any problem.
After the SBA approves a loan application, it goes back to the bank for closing. And this part of the process is where Nini Pamachan comes in. Normally, she works in marketing, but a few weeks ago, she and a few dozen of her colleagues were drafted into the PPP loan effort.
It kind of sprung up, I kind of got like a few days notice, and then all of a sudden, we all just kind of dove in headfirst without really knowing what we were getting ourselves into.
Pamachan is assigned to the inputting team, which just means when a loan is approved, she takes all the info from the forms and spreadsheets and types it into the official loan documents. And while she does miss her old job, she says she knows this one is important to the bank's customers.
They need this money to keep them afloat. And if I can be partly, you know, a cog in that wheel, then I'm proud to do that.
When she's done with an application, someone needs to send it to the customer. And that is where Lindsay St. Pierre comes back in.
Hey, Adrian.
Hey, Lindsay. How was your day?
It was busy. It's always busy.
It is 10 o'clock at night, and St. Pierre is still on her computer, finalizing the details on a virtual stack of approved loan applications.
I've done around 40. I have about 60 or so left.
It's worth mentioning these loans do come with strings attached, and they only cover a couple months' worth of expenses. Also, St. Pierre says one thing that stresses her out about this program is knowing a lot of small businesses that need the money won't get it. And in some cases, the stakes are personal.
A lot of these businesses are people that either I go get my car fixed at or restaurants that I go to. So a lot of them really do hit home.
Do you get to tell the customer that they've been approved?
Yes.
Is it like a celebratory moment? Is it like you're Oprah and you're like, you get a loan?
Definitely. Definitely for the first round, because
since the second round of PPP funding became available in late April, St. Pierre has been able to give more business owners some good news. But in the back of her mind, she knows any day now that money will run out. For Here and Now, I'm Adrian Ma.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.